This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, January 20th, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a conversation with young adult author An Na. She will be speaking on the University of Arkansas campus later this week. Also, we learn what it takes to become a police officer. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas has his weekly business news recap, the latest installment of Arkansongs, and more. But first, the University of Arkansas Fort Smith has been no stranger to headlines lately, from development of the college's 20-year master plan to a shift toward offering bachelor's degrees in nursing. UAFS has been rife with stories. But as Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis reports, more change is on the way in the form of a new degree program.
Just more than a decade ago, the University of Arkansas Fort Smith officially joined the University of Arkansas system. At that time, the college, then known as West Ark Community College, had offerings common to community colleges, mostly trade-related certificate and associate's degree programs, and many students who attended West Ark took general education courses before transferring to a four-year institution. But since 2002, UAFS has transformed into a four-year college, and the university's offerings have grown to include about 40 different majors, many of which offer bachelor's degrees. However, if everything goes according to plan, UAFS will begin offering its first master's degree at about the 2015 academic year. Dr. Ray Wallace, provost and senior vice chancellor of the university, says that the push to begin offering graduate degree programs began about 2 years ago with inquiries to the UAFS College of Health Professions. But he says that just starting a master's degree program isn't simple, as UAFS is accredited as a four-year institution.
To offer our first graduate program, we have to change the role and scope of the university, and that has to be approved at the same time as you propose the program. And it goes all the way from the University of Arkansas System Board to the Arkansas Department of Higher Education Board, and then to the Higher Learning Commission of the North Central Association. And so that's three major steps.
Wallace says that the first step went well for UAFS. The University of Arkansas Board unanimously approved the college's proposal to begin developing the master's degree in healthcare administration. With phase one out of the way, Wallace says that university officials are moving on to step two in the process.
Now what we're doing at this moment is we're waiting on the Arkansas Department of Higher Education to get a committee together of outside evaluators. Those would be people from administrators, deans of healthcare administration, graduate programs, that type of thing, to come down to the university to look at our facilities, to look at our library, to look at our faculty credentials, all of that. And that will happen sometime this early spring.
If that meeting goes well, then another team of Arkansas College deans and administrators will pay a visit and forward its recommendations to the full board of the Arkansas Department of Higher Education. Even then, the North Central Association of the Higher Learning Commission, which is the college's accrediting body, must give its approval of UAFS's plans.
Then we have the Higher Learning Commission sends one or two people to our campus to do a thorough evaluation of what our strengths are vis-a-vis offering this graduate program.
But what exactly will all of these teams of evaluators be looking for when they visit the UAFS campus?
It is important that we are able to show all the bodies that come in to look at us, all those committees, all those evaluators, that we have a very current library, good resources, obviously great faculty, and a curriculum that meets the needs of the regional and, frankly, the national market. And we have that. We have just expanded our library, pretty much doubled our library. Our faculty are very good. We have very solid endowed professorships that we're filling right now, and so that's very solid. And the support, frankly, from the River Valley and Oklahoma and beyond for this program has been quite astonishing, to be quite honest.
If that sounds like a drawn-out process, then you're right. But Wallace says that that's precisely the point.
It's a very critical process because universities, when they change their role and scope, when they move from the ability to offer one type of degree to another, to a higher degree, that first step in that is very deliberate. Some might say slow, but I would say deliberate. And it's an important step in the evolution of this university.
To that end, UAFS Chancellor Paul Barron has been quoted as saying that developing the master's degree in healthcare administration is one of the most important steps in the development of the university.
And I would agree with that. The ability for us to begin to offer selective graduate programs, obviously starting with the master's in healthcare administration, is of massive importance, not just to the university itself, obviously, but also to the economic development and well-being of the community we serve.
In keeping with the community's needs, the new master's program will be an online learning experience, allowing current healthcare professionals to take 33 hours of health and business courses while they continue to work. Wallace says that the choice to make it an online program, rather than a traditional on-campus experience, was a deliberate one.
You know, that's part of the needs analysis that came back when we started surveying folks. And that's what any school within the University of Arkansas system does. There's a lot of surveying and questionnaires to make sure that the degree program that we're offering the community is, in fact, a degree program that, A, they can use, and, B, they can access. And these are all, you know, the people interested in this. We're not talking about people who are not professionals. They're all professionals in the field. And they want advanced degrees for promotions, for advancement in their jobs, for new jobs, and that's why we do that.
And although he couldn't say for sure what other master's degree programs UAFS might develop in the future, Wallace says that offering more graduate degrees fits in well with the campus's master plan.
We have just rolled out the newest model of our master plan. Met with good success, good response from the community and from the university. And part and parcel of that is a graduate program or a series of graduate programs so that we can increase our enrollment in those areas. We will always be primarily focused at the undergraduate level, but we will have, I would imagine we would have selective graduate programs over the next 10 years, obviously, to increase enrollment in that area. But those will always be community-driven, meeting the needs, first and foremost, of our primary audience in this area.
But before any of those other programs are considered, Wallace says that University of Arkansas Fort Smith officials first want to get final approval for the master's degree program in healthcare administration. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Just ahead on Ozarks, last week, President Obama announced the creation of the first of three Manufacturing Innovation Institutes. The Next Generation Power Electronics Innovation Institute includes a consortium of organizations, including one Fayetteville-based company called APEI.
It's been proven that manufacturing is currently growing. In the past 5 months, it's added 80,000 jobs. So the idea is to stimulate the manufacturing sector, especially advanced manufacturing, so very technical manufacturing, and try to create a cutting edge that will make our economy competitive in the manufacturing field.
That's coming up in about 4 minutes on Ozarks at Large. But first, what's on deck for 2014? Economist Kathy Deck tells us, as Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas brings us his weekly business and political news recap.
Speaking at the 20th annual University of Arkansas Economic Forecast Luncheon in Rogers on Thursday, economist Kathy Deck said that for the Arkansas economy, 2014 will look a lot like the experiences of 2013. Deck said that the rate of job growth in the state will continue to be slow, and Arkansas will struggle to reach its pre-recession employment peak. She noted that employment growth in Northwest Arkansas and Central Arkansas has been healthy this past year, but those regional improvements are not enough to compensate for losses in rural areas of the state. Deck also noted that despite population growth in Arkansas, the labor force has seen a decline of 1.2% during the past 4 years. Some reasons for the decline include baby boomer retirees, workers returning to school, and some just giving up looking for work altogether. In what should be his final legislative session, Governor Mike Beebe proposed a $5 billion budget that includes increased funding for prisons and public schools, projected savings from the private option, and a pay hike for public employees. Beebe, who is term limited, will leave office in January 2015. State lawmakers began budget hearings this week in anticipation of the February 10th start to the biennial fiscal session. Bank of the Ozarks reported net income for the fourth quarter of 2013 of a little more than $24 million. That's an 18% increase from 1 year ago. For the full year, net income totaled $87 million, up 13%. Home Bank Shares, the parent company of Centennial Bank, reported record net income for the year ended December 31st of $66.5 million. That compares to $63 million 1 year ago. For the fourth quarter of 2013, Conway-based Home Bank Shares recorded net income of $13 million, down from nearly $17 million 1 year ago. Home Bank Shares acquired Liberty Bank of Jonesboro last summer in a $280 million deal, which dragged on fourth quarter earnings. The acquisition of Metropolitan National Bank by Pine Bluff-based Simmons First led to expected bank branch closings, which were made public this past week by federal regulators. Simmons filed applications with the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency to close 27 branches in parts of Arkansas. Most of the closings are in central and northwest Arkansas, where the two banks have overlapping locations. The 27 branches are slated to cease operations on March 22nd. NanoMech announced it has purchased its existing factory and will build an adjoining state-of-the-art facility in Springdale. The approximate 25,000-square-foot building will triple the size of current operations and serve as the company's world headquarters. The new factory and expanded headquarters will provide for approximately 25 to 50 new jobs for scientists and support staff. NanoMech is a research firm that produces products to strengthen materials, reduce friction to extend the useful life of durable products, and it develops applications to cut down on bacteria strains. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com.
Jazz is in the air every Friday and Saturday evening from 10 p.m. till 1 a.m. right here on KUAF 91.3 FM. From 10 to midnight, it's Shades of Jazz with yours truly, Robert Ginsberg. Daniel Estes takes you from midnight till 1 a.m. on Saturday morning with Goodnight Jazz, and it's Fred Hall's Swing Thing at midnight on Sundays. America's Music, Jazz, on your NPR station KUAF.
This is Ozarks at Large. Last week, President Obama announced the selection of a North Carolina headquartered consortium of businesses and universities led by North Carolina State University to lead a manufacturing innovation institute for next-generation power electronics. The Next Generation Power Electronics Innovation Institute includes the state of North Carolina, 7 universities and national labs, and 18 companies. One of the organizations included in the consortium is a Fayetteville-based company called Arkansas Power Electronics International, or APEI. This is the first of 3 manufacturing institutes that will be created under the National Network for Manufacturing Innovation. According to a news release, President Obama created the $200 million project to support recent growth in domestic manufacturing, stimulate the technology sector, and ensure the continued economic and national security associated with having a strong, advanced manufacturing sector. This first institute is a $140 million initiative. The Department of Energy will award $70 million over 5 years, and that will be matched by at least $70 million in non-federal commitments by the winning team of businesses and universities, along with the state of North Carolina. Last Friday, I spoke with Lauren Kegley, a design engineer at Arkansas Power Electronics International, to learn more.
APEI is a very innovative high-tech company that works on wideband semiconductor devices. device and electronic solutions. So what we do is we create essentially the kind of brick that's on your laptop charger. We create that in a high temperature, high performance version that can go into things like aerospace or hybrid electric vehicles or a number of different very high performance applications. Ultimately, what we'll be doing with this initiative is helping to ramp up our manufacturing facility. So in addition to designing and creating these amazing electronic solutions, we also manufacture the power modules that go inside these solutions.
So how did you become involved with this new $1 million manufacturing institute?
Well, this institute is from the National Network for Manufacturing Innovation, which is a recent initiative under President Obama that is a $200 million initiative to create three different manufacturing institutes in order to try to stimulate the advanced domestic manufacturing sector. So what we did is it was a proposal process, and so we submitted as part of the North Carolina state-led proposal. And we worked with them, created a proposal. They brought together 18 industry partners, two national labs, and I believe four academic partners other than themselves to create this initiative. And so we worked with them to create the proposal.
So what will your part be in all of this as you're working with, like you said, there's about 18 different groups involved in this from across the country. So what will your part be in all of this, you know, here in Fayetteville?
Right. So the entire institute is called the Next Generation Power Electronics Innovation Institute, and it's meant to create more manufacturing in the wide band gap field. And so the entire consortium ranges from device level to experimenting with different applications. What we'll be doing is we will be a packaging foundry. So we'll create the power modules and things like that. We can work both with all the people in the consortium as well as additional partners. But what this initiative will allow us to do is simply create more efficient manufacturing than we already have, allow us to, you know, grow our manufacturing division and ultimately be able to create more products.
What are the benefits of having these manufacturing institutes? Like you said, this is the first of three, so.
The benefits of them will be that it's been proven that manufacturing is currently growing. In the past 5 months, it's added 80,000 jobs. So the idea is to stimulate the manufacturing sector, especially advanced manufacturing, so very technical manufacturing, and try to create a cutting edge that will make our economy competitive in the manufacturing field. So what we're doing is growing this manufacturing department here in Arkansas as well as in the entire United States to help us create more jobs as well as to help the economy.
That was Lauren Kegley, a design engineer at Arkansas Power Electronics International. We spoke by phone late last week. For more information, you can visit apei.net. It is Monday, January 20th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. And joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hi.
Hello.
Can you see Kevin's hand up my back?
I can.
Yes?
I can. I mean,
I would
that
be
might
talking,
be...
Well, it would be weird. Talking about Kevin Kinder, our music editor for What's Up, who is the one who knows about music, obviously.
As he is the music editor.
Exactly. Gosh, it's Monday.
It is Monday.
Shoo. Have you ever heard of a band called Railroad Earth?
I have heard of them, yes.
Have you seen them? Do you know anything about them?
I have
them?
Not seen them. I think I interviewed them for you many moons ago.
Really?
I think so.
All I can tell you is that Railroad Earth has a new album out called Last of the Outlaws, and they will be at George's Majestic Lounge at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. According to Kevin, in the middle of the new album is a 22-minute suite.
Oh, dear.
Of music. Part string band breakdown, part orchestral composition, the songs All That's Dead May Live Again and Face with a Hole. I'm quoting Kevin, showcase a band with a firm grasp on the capabilities of their instruments. Tickets are $20 at 7 o'clock Tuesday, and Kevin seems excited. The band last played in Northwest Arkansas at the Yonder Mountain String Band's Harvest Music Festival.
Yes, I don't think I caught them while I was there. Sorry.
I'm too tired to even think about it. But at least it starts at 7 o'clock.
That's a respectable school night time to start, right?
There you go. So tomorrow night, get out of the house and go see a band.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
We know a sparkling ahead, honey, I thought I'd give you a call. Looking for tomorrow to be sunny in the midst of this snowfall.
Arkansas-er William Robert Thornton was born in Hot Springs in Garland County and raised in Alpine in Clark County. He grew up all around Southwest Arkansas. I never flew on a plane until my 20s, he said. So to me, if you went to Little Rock, you went to the moon. His parents both attended Henderson State in Arkadelphia, as did he, and his father's family was from Glenwood in Pike County. The Thorntons lived in Hatfield and Polk County and also in Union County before moving to Malvern in Hot Spring County when Thornton's father got a job as a basketball coach at Rural Dale School in Lonsdale, back in Garland County. Malvern had a population of about 10,000 people, he later said. So to us, that was like going to Paris.
A girl to bail me out tonight. I don't have the means to help myself.
Paula's record shop in Malvern introduced Thornton to bands like the Mothers of Invention and Black Oak Arkansas. From a teenager, he was playing drums at Arkansas VFW halls and the like. The Arkansas-er was in local Malvern area bands the McCoveys, the Yardleys, and Blue and the Blue Velvets. His band Hotlanta achieved regional success and even recorded at Muscle Shoals, Alabama in the mid-1970s. Drumming with brothers Mike and Nick Shipp of Benton in Saline County, the band Nothin' Doin' opened up for such bands as Black Oak Arkansas and Humble Pie. The trio later became a ZZ Top tribute band called Tres Hombres. He did sound and roadied and also worked for the Hot Spring County Road Department and the Arkansas Highway Department.
I wanna and I gotta and I wanna and I gotta get some of your love.
It was Sharp County native Teddy Wilburn of the Wilburn Brothers who advised Thornton to use the name Billy Bob because no one will ever have to ask you who you are. Teddy and his brother Doyle of Hardy were country music stars themselves. Their other music business pursuits helped launch the careers of Loretta Lynn, Gene Shepherd, and Charlie Louvin, among many others. As a fellow Arkansas-er, Thornton had sought out show business advice from Doyle and Teddy Wilburn in Nashville, Tennessee.
Purple passion.
Teddy Wilburn was right. People remembered the name Billy Bob Thornton. However, when Thornton burst into the public eye, it was not in music, but in film, with 1996's Sling Blade. Shot in Saline and Hot Spring counties, Sling Blade earned Thornton an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay and an Oscar nomination for Best Actor. Daniel Lanois did the film soundtrack. It featured musicians Dwight Yoakam, Vic Chestnut, and Bruce Hampton, as well as fellow Malvernite Rick Dial, who had played in the Brass Button, a rival band of Thornton's in town while growing up. A furniture salesman by trade and longtime voice of the Malvern Leopards, Rick Dial went on to appear in several films before his death in May 2011.
We'll drink purple passion, we'll drink purple passion, we'll drink purple passion.
Film stardom allowed Thornton to fully pursue his musical side, but it may have been a bit of a Faustian bargain for the Arkansas-er as he apparently struggled to completely separate the two artistic visions in the public's mind.
Mama. Used to feed the hobos, now I'm a hobo, I'm a hobo. Mama used to feed the hobos, now I'm a hobo, I'm a hobo.
2001 saw Thornton's first solo release, Pirate Radio. The same year, he did a version of Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire for the Central Arkansas-based Oxford American Magazine's music issue. Thornton followed his debut with 2003's The Edge of the World, 2005's Hobo, and 2007's Beautiful Door. He also covered the Warren Zevon song The Wind for a Zevon tribute album in 2004.
Yeah.
Tell me once more why you're sure you don't need me. Tell me again, but don't think you'll convince me.
Then, calling himself W.R. Bud Thornton, the drummer and singer formed the Boxmasters with Grammy winner J.D. Andrew and Michael Wayne Butler. The trio's debut double album on Vanguard Records, with one disc of Thornton originals and one disc of cover songs, came out in 2008. The covers included The Who, Mel Tillis, Mott the Hoople, and three Nitty Gritty Dirt Band songs, a group for which Thornton had roadied. Later that year, the Boxmasters issued a Christmas album and in 2009 a record called Mod Billy. When playing live, the band had another drummer, so Bud Thornton could be Boxmaster frontman. Thornton's noted prickliness about discussing his movies when he wants to discuss his music came to a head with an infamous April 2009 interview with Canadian Broadcasting Company's Q Radio DJ, Gian Gomeshi, while the Boxmasters were on tour with Willie Nelson. Thornton answered queries with non sequiturs until finally asking,
"Would you say that to Tom Petty?"
and then compared Canadian audiences to mashed potatoes without the gravy. The incident made headlines and the video went viral. Thornton later explained he was referring to the DJ, not Canadians as a whole. The Boxmaster subsequently left the tour, citing illness. "Would you ask Tom Petty that?" briefly became a catchphrase. Perhaps understandably, Thornton seemed to want his music to be heard without context of his acting career. Perhaps less understandably, Thornton didn't even want it mentioned. Unfortunately and ironically, the interview became one of the most talked about facets of Billy Bob Thornton's actually long and indeed storied in its own right musical career.
Why?
Arkansasian musician William Robert Thornton, or W.R. Bud Thornton, or Billy Bob Thornton, of Alpine, Hot Springs, Malvern, and elsewhere in southwest Arkansas, with Two-Bit Grifter from the 2008 debut of the Boxmasters. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook. With Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of KUAR and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer is Keith Merks. For more information, go to arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. To become an accountant, one must go to business school, then take the CPA exam. To become a lawyer, one goes to law school, then takes the bar exam. But how does one become a police officer? Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas visited the Rogers Police Department to find out.
The Rogers Police Department employs 96 officers, but the city allows for them to have 105 officers. Next month, on February 6th, the department will be holding an entry-level police officer examination, and they're looking for people from all walks of life to try out. Potential officers must be at least a 21-year-old U.S. citizen with no felonies and at least a high school degree. Keith Foster is the communications officer with the Rogers Police Department. He says the biggest requirement is to have a good character.
You know, for us, character, integrity, that's kind of the, that's everything in our career. And everything we do is based off our integrity. And once we lose that integrity, we're ineffective as an officer. We can teach you the skills to be a police officer, but we can't teach someone to have good character. They either have it or they don't.
Being a policeman is much more than blue lights and a badge. Good communication skills are key.
You're either on the scene somewhere and you're talking with someone and you're trying to find out exactly what happened, you know, to get their side of the story. And you have to be, you know, work one way with victims. And then when you get someone that's a suspect, you know, then you kind of may kick into an interrogation phase. And so being able to make those transitions back and forth and being able to talk to them in the different ways. And then let's say you go through and you figure everything out and you go ahead and you arrest the suspect in that. Well, then you've got to come back and you've got to be able to write a good report.
It doesn't matter how well an investigation was conducted if a proper report cannot be written. A bad report means a bad guy is going to go free. Foster says a good officer will write everything down in anticipation of legal scrutiny.
The judge sees them, the defense sees them, the prosecution sees them, and they go through and they get nitpicked. So we have to make sure that when we're going through and doing those reports, everything is in there, that we do everything accurate, and we try to put as much in there as possible because, you know, for us, when we get on the you know, in court, if it's not in the report, it didn't happen. You can't sit there and later say, oh, wait, I remember this. Well, it's not in the report, so that does you no good.
Foster says about 50 people will sign up to take the test, and of those, 35 will actually show up on February 6th. The written exam consists of English, following directions, attention to detail, and ability to follow a map. When finished, the written test is graded immediately, and while it's being graded, the prospects head outside for physical agility testing.
You'll start from the ground with a kneeling position, and you'll stand up. You'll run over, you'll run up and down a flight of stairs a couple times, kind of, you know, getting your heart rate up. Then we have a machine that we kind of go over that you get to fight with. And then from there, you'll do a sprint for a certain distance. Then you'll come back. We have a body drag, which is basically a dummy, and you've got to drag it so many feet. Now, it's supposed to be, I think, like 180 pounds, but come on, it's got wet sand in there, so it's probably closer to 200 somewhere in there. And then after you've done all that, you're exhausted, you got your heart rate up, we've got a stand with basically it's a bar with a circle on top, and we have a pistol, and you'll pull the pistol 17 times with one hand and then switch the other and then do 16 on that. And just to see, can you keep it in the circle? After you've got your heart rate up, can you calm yourself enough to be able to do that?
It's an unloaded gun, but in the line of duty, there will be bullets. An officer would also have on a bulletproof vest, so the test takers must also don one. It weighs about 20 pounds. The department will lose about 10 prospects in this testing stage, leaving 25 remaining to go on to interviews with both the Civil Service Commission and command officers in the department. 10 to 15 people pass the interviews and move on to the background check, psych evaluations, and polygraph test. All in all, only two or three people will make it through this process and actually be hired by the Rogers Police Department. But you're not done yet. A new officer will be sent to one of two police academies in the state, either in Camden or Elm Springs. The academies are run by the state of Arkansas, but they do use a lot of local police officers to teach classes. It's actually a lot of classroom work, learning different laws, the math and physics of accident investigation, and evidently, it's nothing like the 1984 film Police Academy. Foster tells people if the only thing you know about law enforcement is what you see on TV and in the movies, then you don't know anything about law enforcement at all. That's just Hollywood.
I've seen talking dogs and flying cats in the movies. It doesn't mean they're really there. So don't believe that stuff that you see in the theater. It's never accurate.
Foster says he can't watch serious police dramas like Law & Order or CSI because he nitpicks them too much. But he does like the funny ones, like Super Troopers. New officers don't just hit the road as soon as they graduate from the police academy. They ride along with a training officer, observing their actions and watching them take the theory of doing the job and applying that theory. Over the three-month period, new officers spend time with a few different training officers, all the while receiving reviews and evaluations of their own work. Officer Foster says one of the great things about entering law enforcement is this is all paid training.
You know, if you want to go learn a lot of occupations, you've got to spend your time and money to go do that, right? So you want to be a teacher. Well, you got to spend your money to go to the university, get your teaching degree. You want to be a plumber or electrician. You got to spend your time and your money to go and learn those skills and those trades. Well, with us, once you make it through that hiring process and the interview process, and we go ahead and hire you, from that moment on, you're being paid. You're a paid employee of the department. We pay to send you to training. We buy all your equipment. We buy your uniforms. You get insurance. You're collecting vacation. All that stuff. You're fully employed by us at that point.
So where does a cop learn that authoritative attitude?
You know, I keep thinking of Cartman from South Park. I'm a cop and you will respect my authority. No, there's no training on that. We don't have a classroom for it, but you do have to have, you know, we call it that command presence, and you're on the scene, and it's chaos, and it's crazy. You've got to be that solid, steady person. And so, you know, I've said before, you know, we don't really have a sense of humor, which isn't true. We have a sense of humor about stuff, but we're trying to do everything right.
Communications officer Keith Foster was 30 when he became an officer of the law. Having been in the Army, law enforcement seemed a good fit. An entry-level police officer examination will be given at the Rogers Police Department February 6th. To be eligible to test, applications must be turned in by January 27th at 4 p.m. For more information about a career with the Rogers Police Department, visit the website rogersarkansas.com/police. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Anna has certain things in common with the protagonist of her novel, A Step from Heaven. Like the character Young Ju, Anna was born in Korea and moved with her family to the United States when she was very young. The author does include some real memories in the novel, but most of the character's experiences are fiction. The book earned praise when it was published in 2001. It was awarded the Michael L. Prince Award as the best book written for teens, based entirely on literary merit. Anna will speak on the University of Arkansas campus this month, and she spoke to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums from her home in Vermont last week. Critics and reviewers have commended the characters in her book for speaking and thinking as a child, without the text ever becoming condescending or too precocious. In A Step from Heaven, that meant writing for a character that ages from 4 to 18 in fewer than 200 pages.
Internally, I struggled a lot with trying to portray a young child's voice with all the kind of complex nuances that children have. And I think it's one of the things that, we assume that kids have just simple grammar or simple ideas or whatever it is. But the way that I wanted to approach portraying Young Ju as a child was to try to really be in her eyes. And I remember reading Angela's Ashes and being blown away, just struck by how wonderfully he was able to capture that young boy's voice, or his young, inner child's voice. And one of the things that I realized was part of the view of looking from within, at that age, is that you often misunderstand things, or your impressions of people or ideas or things, they have their own kind of, magical quality or spin to it. And so I really tried to see her world from her eyes. Even just imagining her height, the way that if you're small and you have to look up at people, what are the things that you notice? Or language, acquiring language, what are the kinds of sounds and syllables? What does a foreign language sound like to a young child?
Well, it's really interesting because in A Step from Heaven, you have her at one point wondering about the word going. And her friends say so-and-so is going with someone, but she can't quite figure out the context.
Right. And that happened to me as a preteen. And kids, at that point, were speaking about dating, and I had no idea what that word was. And so that really does come from my own experience of trying to figure out different cultural kind of idioms. And it's speaking Korean at home and speaking English at the school, there were a lot of gaps in my understanding. And that's, again, part of, portraying accurately that kind of childhood wonder. Well, there's also a cultural wonder. What is that about, this word going? Or what do people eat on Thanksgiving besides Korean food?
Well, and even, I think just part of being a child, and the adult world always seemed so mysterious to me. I remember hearing the term changing hands. A business was changing hands. And you're somewhat afraid to ask, or you think maybe you, and so there's this whole other world, this adult world that you don't quite get and you wonder about, and you capture that magnificently.
Oh, thank you. It's amazing what kids create. When they don't, I think that's part of the charm, is when they don't understand and they don't necessarily ask you, they will create an entire definition and meaning that they, they believe is true. And it's really, it's quite striking. I find that one of the most magical parts of childhood.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's a crossword puzzle that you have to fill in, so you do the best you can.
Exactly.
With the life experience you have.
Right.
A Step from Heaven is, in the copy I have, is 170 or so pages. It takes place over about 14 years, and yet it never feels rushed. It never feels like there are gaps. You do it with such an economy of words. I would think that would be harder to create an entire sort of character than using many words.
The beauty of those vignettes, or the form itself, I struggled again trying to find the right form to tell this story, and I really do feel like the story took on the form that it needed to, because vignettes inherently leave space for readers to imagine, and it's a poetic form, so there's a sense of depth, you know, in a short amount of time or space. And I also, you know, chose it very specifically because it felt like the way that my memories worked when I thought about growing up and immigrating from Korea to the United States. You know, we don't have our lives play out in an entire kind of, you know, one from beginning to end type of thing. What we do have are very episodic, very important, very visceral kinds of moments or smells or tastes or touch or, you know, some kind of visual. It's so I felt like the vignette form really captured the way that people remember their lives. And I wanted to be able to have readers not only identify with Young Ju, but also feel as though they were living her life in some way, you know, taking on that first person really deeply and moving through her memories, basically having those memories with her as she was growing up.
One thing that Young Ju is told before she goes to America and then shortly after is she can be anything she wants to be. And at one point she says maybe she'll be president, and she's laughed at. And it turns out they don't think you can be anything you want to be. So she finds out that being a girl is, and that's not the only time, but being a girl is different than being a boy.
Right, especially within her household. Yeah, definitely very clear cultural markers there. I mean, I think obviously there's gender inequality anywhere, but having grown up in a pretty patriarchal family and culture, it was something I was struck by when I was growing up. It was just known that, you know, sons were preferred in some ways. My parents would joke about having daughters and that they kept trying until they had a son. So it was just one of those things I felt always, you know. And I think the difference was made much more real because I was negotiating two cultures of being in the United States but also feeling Korean when I was home. So having that marked difference of gender inequality was something that I really, not that I played that out, but I think it's just true to the culture, to the Korean culture at that time. I know a lot of it has changed, but I feel like there's still that kind of inherent understanding within Korean Americans and Koreans. Boys are definitely honored in a different way than women are.
You and Young Ju share a sort of basic history. It's inevitable that some people, when they know that, will think that this is an autobiography. How do you deal with that?
Oh, yes. That is a question that I get quite often. I deal with it by saying it is and it isn't. I think with any form of writing, even memoir or nonfiction writing memoir, there's a certain element of fiction that just creeps in. And so though I started from a place of wanting to capture some of the memories that I had, the book soon kind of diverged from my own upbringing and my own path to Young Ju's path and the character that she was in this book. And I tell people all the time she is a much braver, much wiser, much better person in so many ways, stronger, more noble. You know, the things that she struggled with in her family was so much greater, the adversities, compared to many of the things that I went through. I was well supported by my family. My father always believed, you know, I was going to go to college, even though I was a girl. It was just assumed, you know, we are all going to college. There was a great deal of support for my writing when I decided to get my master's. So there were so many people in my life, my family, my community, that supported me in a way that Young Ju never got. I mean, it's just, it's one of those things that I think I was very fortunate, but I also know that there are many stories out there where children, young women, girls, all struggling to get to that dream, and they don't have the same kinds of support systems that I did. So it's a hard question, because often, you know, there are moments when you go into the book and you say, well, did that happen? And I can tell you, oh, yeah, that Coke thing, the bubbles in the nose, remember that so vividly.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I have that noted here, because it's the first time a child who has never been, whose taste buds, I take it, have never been anything close to Coca-Cola. And it's such a vivid memory. It's so well described.
Oh, it's clearly etched in my memory. The first time I had Coke, it was completely baffling that anybody would want to drink this acid biting drink. And of course, you know, you burp and it goes right into your nose. And I just remembered tearing up, like, what is this? Yeah, up until that point, I had drank tea and water and milk, and that was about it. So carbonated drinks were something I avoided for a long time.
Well, and there was this thing that happens when you're a child, that happens when you're describing it. It's not pleasurable. And then one of the adults says, you know, go ahead and drink that, and you can have some more.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing you're thinking is, I don't want any more.
Right. Very different perspectives from adults and childhood.
Of course, Young Ju is born in Korea, comes to the United States, feels cultural differences. So every person who reads this is not reading it in the same way. But there is that universal sort of theme of otherness, of being secluded or not part of a group. And that speaks in this book. You don't have to be male, female, young. I think you get to the heart of that over and over.
I think alienation, shame, difference, all those themes that children, young people struggle with, feeling alone compared to their peers, you know, family life versus school or, you know, outside exterior life, those are all themes that I think a lot of children resonate with. And I definitely, in school visits and talks, have found that children really gravitate to the ideas because they have felt them, whether they're immigrants or not. They understand. You know, they might have felt ashamed of their parents at one point, or ashamed of some situation, or alone with their thoughts, you know, when everybody else was doing something else. And I think those are obviously childhood themes that anyone can relate to.
There's a vignette where Young Ju has convinced her mother to spend a dollar on a lottery ticket. And she's convinced, pretty convinced, that there's a real good chance that their family will win the $23 million. And she counts down the clock. She can barely finish her dinner. And then she comes out and watches the television. And in a flash, the numbers are red. She only has one of the proper ones. And there is this sentence. She has this realization that a dollar for afternoon dreams is expensive and cheap. That is a wonderful sentence, and without over-romanticizing, without too many words, you've summed up one of those realizations you have when you're going from childhood to adulthood. It's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I definitely played the lottery and still play every once in a while for fun. And I do. It is really a moment for me to dream and to play. And my daughters and I, you know, get together and we pick out the numbers and we laugh and we talk about, well, what would you do? And it's one of those things that it's bittersweet that way, especially for Young Ju. I see the more of the kind of playfulness of it now, but back then, and especially Young Ju in her situation, it's so bittersweet. And that was the first vignette where I really started to understand what the story, how this story would shape up. So that's one of my favorite vignettes that I often read and that I come back to over and over again.
I would imagine many of your readers are younger than you and I are.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were writing A Step from Heaven, there are a couple of times when she and her brother reference cartoons or television shows that were on when I was young, when you were young.
Oh, you remember. That's wonderful.
You know, Wonder Twins activate.
Yes.
You just throw that in. And I'm curious, are you ever concerned that maybe a current 13 or 12-year-old may have no idea what that means?
You know, so here's the trick about writing so you don't necessarily date yourself. You don't give too many examples. Like, you try to avoid words like iPod. I mean, nowadays it's just so, you know, it's ubiquitous. But in 10 years, it might not be the iPod. It might be,
right,
you know, something else. And so we try to, you know, we encourage, when I'm teaching writing, I talk about generalizing, you know, music player, whatever it is, like give it something a little bit generic or maybe a little bit different. Just spin the words a little bit. But some things like Wonder Twin Powers, you know, these are TV references that I know nobody except a certain generation of us will understand, but it still has that same resonance. Like, it's a cartoon, and this idea of Wonder Twins, you know, that could be now. It could be, you know, 20 years from now, 20 years past, you know, whatever it is. I think it felt, at least when I was going through and revising and looking at all those kind of very specific cultural or generational markers, it felt, you know, generic enough, but at the time specific enough to just kind of throw in there.
What will you talk about when you're in Fayetteville at the University of Arkansas?
So I'm going to be talking about, the title of my talk is called The Power of One Voice. And it comes from this idea of, you know, obviously it's going to be Martin Luther King's birthday on Monday. And I wanted to just to touch upon a couple different kind of political issues that are running through my mind right now, but also historical issues and also personal, you know, personal power in terms of having the ability to affect change.
Anna is the author of several books, including A Step from Heaven, Wait for Me, and The Fold. She'll speak on the University of Arkansas campus Thursday night at 7 inside Giffel's Auditorium in Old Main. The talk, sponsored by the College of Education and Health Professions and the Brown Chair in English Literacy, is free and open to the public. She talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums last week.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, Dorothea Lange's legendary Depression-era photographs documented a nation in suffering. What was it like to be under her gaze?
I was a little afraid of her, because the closer you were to her, the more likely you were to come in for her trying to make you the best you could be.
Dorothea Lange's goddaughter, next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Huntsville. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. We're going to close out this edition of Ozarks at Large with congratulations to Barrett Baber. Barrett is a local musician and a Fayetteville High School teacher. He won the National Grammy Gig of a Lifetime contest. Barrett and his band will fly to Los Angeles for a week. That includes a performance at the famous Nokia Theater. The song Baber won the contest with is called Drop Dead Redhead, and it's off his 2013 album Battlefield Us. His band includes Miguel Gamboa on drums, Greg Guillot on bass, Aaron Schauer on piano, and TJ Scarlett on lead guitar, and Barrett delivers lead vocals and plays rhythm guitar. They are going to open up for The Neighborhood at the Grammy Gig of a Lifetime concert in Los Angeles, and you can catch the Grammy live performance January 26th at CBS.com. But here Barrett is now with his performance of Drop Dead Redhead inside our Furman Garner Performance Studio last summer. Thanks again for listening, and enjoy the rest of your Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Up on the right-hand side, I slowed down, said, what's your name?